Hi, this is Newt. 2020 is going to be one of the most extraordinary election years of our lifetime. I want to invite you to join my inner circle as we discuss each twist and turn in the presidential race in my members-only Inner Circle Club. You'll receive special flash briefings, online events, and members-only audio reports from me and my team. Here is a special offer for my podcast listeners. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. And if you sign up for a 1 or 2 year membership, you'll get 10% off your membership price and a VIP fast pass to my live events. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. Use the code podcast at checkout. Sign up today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast and use the code podcast. Hurry, this offer expires February 14th. On this episode of Newt's World, I've been a huge fan of the movies since I was a very young kid. I used to go to the dark, air-conditioned theater on a hot summer afternoon and watch two films at a time, double features, from the time I was about 9 years old. When I was a child, going to the movies was a special treat, and every movie I saw left a great impression on me. I think movies are a defining part of our American culture. Movies allow us to travel the world, experience tragedy, love, and nearly every other emotion. They help us understand a world of good versus evil, as in the permanent classic Casablanca, and they reflect a moment in time. On this episode, I'm sharing some of my favorite movies of all time and recommending some of the classics I encourage you to check out. The truth is, I love movies. I've loved movies my whole life. I think they're one of the great contributions to modern artistic achievement. I find myself, when I fly back and forth between Rome and Washington on a 9-hour flight, I'll often watch 2 or 3 movies, and I'm enthralled. And I thought it would be fun just to talk about the movies, why I like them so much. I got fascinated with movies when I was very, very young. And in fact, by the 4th grade, I was reading a book on how to be a movie director. And it was a fascinating book because you're a little kid. My dad was stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas at the time in the U.S. Army. And I was at the Junction City Elementary School. And I found this book in the library. And it was magic. And it talked about how do you write a scene and how do you set up the stage and how do you edit the movie and how do you get the music to work. All these different components that we sort of take for granted because we go and we sit and we are surrounded by this remarkable achievement that takes hundreds of people. If you watch most major movies, at the very end when they start going through the credits, it's astonishing how many people it takes to make a movie. And so even from a very early age, I was just utterly fascinated. And then we had a period where we went back from Fort Riley to Hummelstown, Pennsylvania, where I had originally grown up. It turned out that the movie theater owner really liked me. And so I could go watch all the movies I wanted to. Well, you can imagine how that affected me. So from a very early age, I became enthralled by movies. I like action films particularly. I like dramas, like an awful lot of sentimental, romantic people. I love Casablanca. I can watch it 3 or 4 times a year and just marvel at how this movie came together. I mean, nobody who made it thought it was going to become a great classic, and yet it did. And there's wonderful stories just around that one movie. So all of these different pieces intrigued me. Some of them were based on the fact that for me, and this has changed, of course, because now we watch movies on our tablet or our telephone. We watch movies on an airplane on a small screen. We watch movies at home on our TV set. But I'm old enough that I grew up when you actually went and you sat in a dark room and you looked up and you were surrounded. You were surrounded by a huge screen. This is why people like John Wayne seemed so big. When you have a giant screen and you throw somebody on that giant screen, they are really big. When you then put them on what John Ford, the director, always thought was the most powerful figure in the movies, which was a moving horse. He always believed that horses just really brought to life the sense of power and movement. And then you add to that really good music, and suddenly you have quite an adventure going on. So I grew up when most people saw most movies in movie theaters. And in fact, I'm old enough that I remember in the 50s in Harrisburg, people went to the movies in the summer because they were air conditioned. And air conditioning was still pretty rare. So you either went to the bar or the movie in order to sit in air conditioning during the hottest days of the year. Part of my life was shaped as a very young person, about 10 or 11 years of age. This was back when life was simpler and safe. And so my mother sent me on the trolley car, which still existed back then, from Hummelstown to downtown Harrisburg. And I went to a double feature on an afternoon. One of the two movies was Trader Horn. They were both African films. And I came out of the movie just totally excited. And I'd seen lions and giraffes and, you know, snakes and monkeys and all sorts of things. And as I walked out, I saw a sign pointing through the alley that said City Hall. And so I decided, my grandmother always told me to do your duty. I thought Harrisburg needed a zoo. So I walked through that alleyway and ended up seeing the head of the Parks Department and ultimately going back and talking to the city council. All that happened because I was so excited sitting in that room, being transported to a world totally different. So I'm one of those people who gets totally lost in movies. I don't think of movies as some distant thing or some artificial thing. I'm in the middle of them. I live them and I love them. And I think that they're remarkable. I also think that they're so extraordinarily complicated. And you have people who come from so many different backgrounds. One of my favorite examples of that is the remarkable English director who came over in the late 30s, having already made a great career in Britain, Alfred Hitchcock. And one of my favorite stories, which taught me a lot as a manager, because again, I go to these things and I try to learn about everything. So I read a very interesting book called Memo from Selznick. David O. Selznick was one of the great producers of the late 1930s. He had produced Gone with the Wind, which was far and away the biggest movie of that era. And Selznick's technique was to look at that day's rushes, which were literally, they would rush the film. This was still back when you had real film. They would rush it over and you could look at it late in the evening. So Selznick would look at that day's shooting and he would then dictate until 2 or 3 in the morning specific thoughts for the director. Maybe you should rethink this. Maybe you should cast a dress a little differently. Maybe we need a different kind of music. And so if you read Memo from Selznick, which is a great book, it has a whole section on the memos he wrote to Alfred Hitchcock, who he'd brought into the U.S. to film a movie. Well, years later, after I'd read that, I saw an interview with Hitchcock, who said, it was asked by this reporter, he said, "You've been a very famous movie director in Great Britain, and now you come to the U.S., and all of a sudden you go from being totally independent to having Selznick, who's one of the most hands-on producers in Hollywood, sending you all these memos. I mean, how did you react to that?" And Hitchcock looked at him for a second and got a funny smile and he said, "You know, I have always wondered what was in those memos because it never occurred to me as a director to care what the producer sent me." And so I had the sudden insight, here's a guy who is working all night dictating, thinking that Hitchcock's going to read it. Hitchcock thinks it's weird and reads none of it. And yet Selznick thought he was having a huge impact. And in my own leadership style, I really got to be very careful about assuming that anybody was reading anything that I sent them, because I learned from Hitchcock and from Selznick to be very, very careful and not to assume that the other guy was going to do what you wanted them to. So that was an example where I wasn't just involved in the movies as an art experience or the movies as an entertaining experience. I was also fascinated with the mechanics, with the business, with the financing, with all of the different pieces of it. Now, one of my favorite small films is a movie called The Stuntman with Peter O'Toole. And it's a movie about a guy who's trying to hide from the police, and he ends up hiding on this movie set. And O'Toole figures out that he is vulnerable and can be exploited. In the great tradition of Hollywood, O'Toole is the kind of director who'd exploit anybody. And so he says, "I'll hide you and pay you, and you can be my stuntman." And so this young guy goes walking around with O'Toole. And one of the great moments of the movie, O'Toole says, remember, King Kong is 3'8". And the guy looks at him and says, what? He said, this is the movies. It's not what you see on the screen the way you think you see it. It's what we put on the screen. The Stuntman is a marvelous small film that really opens up aspects of movie making that I think are just absolutely terrific and give you a slightly better feeling for how the movies worked. Now, I'm also fascinated because I'm a historian by training. So all the way back to Thomas Edison, the invention of the modern motion picture, the early years when they're silent films, then they're talkies, but they're still black and white. And then ultimately they have Technicolor and then into the modern era. And you watch this evolution of capabilities and you watch the different kind of people learn how to do different kind of shots, different kinds of editing. And then you begin to get into the period where you have remarkable composers. It strikes me when we think about great composers, and we often think about historically great composers. Well, I would argue that John Williams certainly fits in the league of great composers, that his music is astonishingly powerful. As somebody who loves Westerns, I can tell you that Elmer Bernstein to me, whether it's in The Magnificent Seven or it is in any one of 25 films that he scored, how do these guys who are writing the music figure out just as the scene shifts, how they're going to make it look different and how they're going to make it somehow make the music fit exactly what's happening? I was very struck years ago reading that in making High Noon, one of the things they did is they put four beats before they would cut the scene. So you began in the back of your head when you heard the beats, you knew something was going to happen. And they were conditioning you with audio to anticipate what was going to happen in the movie itself. High Noon, which was certainly in its time one of the great films of that generation, built this suspense and built this kind of haunting feeling that was Gary Cooper at his very best. And it was really quite a remarkable film. And of course, you go from very small movies, which could be made for almost nothing, with a very tiny cast, shot in a very specific location, sometimes shot in one or two rooms, to giant films. Ben-Hur, for example. And it's fascinating. I actually saw the 1950s version of Ben-Hur at the theater in Washington, which was a huge screen with a huge sound projection. And it was a remarkable experience to see the totality, first of Miklos Rozsa's remarkable music, but then the way in which Charlton Heston played the lead role, the totality of the script. Ben-Hur itself, of course, had been an extraordinarily successful book in the late 19th century and had a huge impact. There's a huge underlying emotional and religious component to Ben-Hur that made it one of the most remarkable films of the 1950s. When I go into a movie theater, or nowadays when I'm on an airplane and I turn on a movie, I start with the idea that I don't know what's going to happen. And I'm leaning forward and I'm curious. And I let the movie teach me. So I never have expectations. I never measure the movie against something. But I want to know, where's the movie going? I just recently watched Tarantino's film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is a remarkable film. And frankly, carried me to spaces I would never have imagined. And both captured the Hollywood of that era. And I thought with DiCaprio, did just an amazing job of really acting a unique role and not a particularly positive role for him. And I admired the way in which he did that because I thought that it was very compelling and very powerful. Brad Pitt occupies a space as a charismatic figure. I mean, DiCaprio is a great actor, and I enormously admire his work. But Pitt has the kind of charisma that a Sean Connery has, or the kind of charisma that a Clark Gable would have had two generations ago. When you watch the movie, it's fascinating to watch just how the interplay and how they occupy the space. Tarantino is one of the great modern directors, always slightly whacked, always doing things that are slightly different, but worth watching just because you don't quite know where he's going to take you. Coming up, I'll discuss my five top movies of all time. This is week four of my profile plan journey, and Debbie and I are discussing food variety and recipes with our profile coach, Abby. We're really grateful for your counseling. I can tell you that You've already made a difference in getting me focused and getting me thinking. I now carry my profile bars so that I can have a snack at 10 and a snack at 3 or 4. And that actually today helped me because I was in a room that was filled with brownies.
That's great. Having that bar and planning ahead can really help deter those challenging moments.
I've been having great success, but I am getting kind of bored of the same vegetables over and over again. So any tips?
So one of the big things that we advocate for with Profile is veggies, like you said. So we really have to continue to have variety. We have tons of recipes on our website, profileplan.com. We have a whole list of vegetables listed on your grocery list, and pick something on there that you've never had before, and you can simply search for it on our website.
Great suggestion.
And when we're finding recipes, we have them sorted according to plan on our website, so it's very easy for you to know which recipe you can use and work those into your plan, so then you know what to get at the grocery store.
If you go to the profileplan.com, you really do have a whole series of entrees that give you a pretty wide range.
That's the nice thing about Profile is there is a variety of food. This time of the year, it's football season, and so we have tons of different recipes that you can have so that you can still have a healthy choice even when you're entertaining.
That's really guaranteeing that we're going to avoid boredom.
Thank you so much for your time today, Newt and Debbie. You're both doing a great job by taking control of your health. And next week, we're going to talk about activity and goal setting.
Sign up now to start losing weight today. You can do it with a Profile coach like Abby guiding you through the process every step of the way. Go to profileplan.com/Newt. Right now, Newt's World listeners get an exclusive offer, $100 off a one-year Profile membership by visiting profileplan.com/Newt. Get your health journey started today with a free Profile coach consultation at your nearest Profile location or by visiting profileplan.com/NEWT.
One of the films which was absolutely vital to my growing up in my childhood was The Magnificent Seven, which was a film based on the great Japanese film, The Seven Samurai, by Akira Kurosawa. And The Seven Samurai is based on a Japanese legend and is then translated into the modern American West. It's a morality tale. It's a tale about a little village which is being preyed upon by bad guys. And these guys who are sort of amoral and don't think of themselves as out there on a moral crusade, but they do what they do because it's who they are. And watching the way that film comes together, it is truly a remarkable film. And I think that it showed when you have a great director and you have a great cast, like a Yul Brynner, a Steve McQueen, and then you have Elmer Bernstein's remarkable score, and you had a remarkably good script. The first scene is the bad guys in the Mexican village proving how really bad they are, and the Mexican villagers deciding they have to go and buy guns and try to defend themselves. And then the second scene is in this border town, and the corset salesman who's traveling through is offered to put up some money to bury a guy who was laying on the sidewalk. And the opening part of that is the undertaker explaining he can't bury him because there's an element in town that doesn't believe that you should have an Indian up in Boot Hill. And that whole conversation, which first of all, at the time that The Magnificent Seven came out, was a very interesting step towards breaking down our assumptions about being prejudiced. If you watch it and think of it in the context of that era, it's really making an interesting statement. The guy says, look, I want to help, because there's a great line, which I've never forgotten, where he says, you know, he's not turning into any nosegay. I mean, the guy's laying there dead. And the guy says, well, I don't have any choice. My driver is left. At which point, Yul Brynner, one of the best single scenes he ever shot, just says, oh, hell, if that's all you need. And the scene of Brynner with the music in the background walking across this dirt street to get up in the hearse, Steve McQueen turns to the stagecoach guy and says, can I borrow your shotgun? And he says, yeah. He says, I want to see this. So McQueen goes over, and at first you're not quite sure, and you can tell the Brenner's not quite sure. Is he coming over to stop him or help him? And he gets up there. Brynner turns and says, you ever rode shotgun in a hearse before? And he said, no. He said, you know, I don't mind going up. I just want to make sure I come back down. And the whole rest of that scene is a marvelous 4 or 5 minutes of capturing a whole range of attitudes, ideas, stories, language, all in this one little segment. It's the sort of thing that just makes me love movies and make me want to be able to see them, to think about them, to encourage my friends to watch them. And sometimes the movie works even when you know it doesn't work. I mean, if you watch one of the most famous and revered movies of all time, Casablanca, the fact is Casablanca shouldn't work. There are scenes in there that are so hokey. I'm sure at the time they were shooting it, they were thinking to themselves, are we really going to get away with this? But what you had was early in World War II, a movie set, and by the way, a substantial number of the people in Casablanca are themselves refugees from Nazi Germany. So the roles they're playing of refugees in Casablanca trying to get to America, they are playing with an intensity and a sense of reality, which is astonishing, totally believable. But the script on some occasions is a little beyond goofy, including at the very end when Humphrey Bogart announces that they're going to walk across the desert from Casablanca to Dakar, which would be crossing the entire Sahara. He turns and he says, "Louis, this is the beginning of a great friendship." Well, it's a hokey line. It's a line that shouldn't work. But in the context of the total impact of that movie, it works amazingly well. And that's why Casablanca, I suspect, is one of the 5 or 6 most frequently revived movies in terms of people just randomly watching it. And I notice that, for example, on airplanes, when you have a section called classics, it almost always is in that section. Now, from a totally different standpoint, you almost always have in the same section Breakfast at Tiffany's, which is one of my favorite movies, partly because Audrey Hepburn is just so astonishing. I mean, she's beautiful. She's a great actress. Calista and I recently, we were flying home together, and we decided that we would watch Roman Holiday, which I had seen many years ago, but I really had forgotten much of it. I recommend it very highly. It's the movie which introduces and really makes her a star. And you're looking at this very young, very new actress with Gregory Peck. And interestingly, she gets equal billing with Peck. And the reason is he turned to William Wyler, who was the producer-director, and he said, "Look, she's going to be such a big star that I will look stupid if I take top billing and we don't have equal billing," which is both generous on Peck's side and also accurate, because she won in her very first big movie, she won an Academy Award for Best Actress. See, what I like in part about movies is the director has the option of telling you the director's story. And when you watch Roman Holiday, it's an unfolding of an interesting story that ultimately is about two human beings and a concept coming out of World War II, which was very big in that period, and that is the concept of duty. And Audrey Hepburn is a princess. She's tired of being a princess. She has one day where she hides and she's in Rome and she is wandering around with Peck. Peck is actually a little bit of a scoundrel. He is a reporter and he is kind of courting her because he wants the big story about the princess. And then, of course, he falls in love with her, so he can't do the story. So it's a little bit of hokey shtick, if you will, but it works. And you watch this and you watch the two of them play off each other. And you're watching two of the great actors of their generation. And with William Wyler, you're watching one of the great directors and producers of that generation. There's a certain travelogue quality to it as they wander around on a Vespa and ride around the city together. And so I just recommend it to you, both because it's a great introduction to Audrey Hepburn. It's a great introduction to Rome in one of its more interesting ways. And it's a significant part of movie history. And I think movie history really matters. When we come back, I'll discuss what the movies teach us about good and evil. There are also moments when movies reflect a moment in time. I remember we were in trouble as a country. We had come out of the Vietnam War badly. We were being torn apart by our own internal political dissent. There was a great sense on the left that you didn't have to have a strong military, you didn't have to defend yourself. And along came this movie called Star Wars. And I'll never forget sitting in the theater, watching it, and realizing that what Star Wars was doing, it was reestablishing the mythology of good and evil, reestablishing the mythology that some people have to be prepared to fight in order for freedom to survive. And it was establishing the mythology that some people are so bad, you have to defeat them. And Star Wars, in that sense, was actually reflecting a moment of change. I mean, part of the reason it was so enormously powerful, in addition to being just a great film. Nowadays, we have so many computer-generated capabilities. We have so many movies that are extraordinarily expensive that it doesn't quite have the punch that it had back then. When it first came out, it had a kind of miraculous feel to it. And you were both totally sucked into the Force will be with you. The effect of it at that moment in the American psyche was to remind us that the good guys are supposed to win, that the good guys are supposed to go out and beat the bad guys, and that you can really clearly tell the difference. And it was just fascinating to me in that period looking at this. And there were a series of films that came along in approximately that same time, each of which made in its own unique way this continuous focus on the notion that there was good and evil, that some people had to stand up for the good, even at great risk, and that you had to be prepared to do it. One of my favorites is The Wind and the Lion, directed by John Milius, with Sean Connery, Candice Bergen. If you've never seen it, I cannot too strongly recommend that you see it for a lot of different reasons. I think it is so astonishingly well done. Another one, though, was Death Wish, which was really about the bad guys and the need for some vigilante to begin cleaning the place up. Another one in that same period was a film like The Deer Hunter, which were designed to prove that the war was terrible, that it did terrible damage. But at the same time, we were getting films which kept revalidating the idea that you have to be prepared to do what it takes in order for freedom, in order for your family, in order for the bad guys to be defeated and the good guys to win. And of course, coming through that whole period, you had the rise of Clint Eastwood, who went from being a pretty junior player on Rawhide to gradually emerging as Dirty Harry. And again, it was this notion of, here's the guy who stands between us and evil. This is the guy who's going to do what it takes, even if it means breaking the rules. In those kind of films, the directors always made sure that the bad guys were sufficiently bad that you felt that it was appropriate for them to be blown away. He's pretty consistently protecting the innocent and protecting the helpless, and you do have this sense of justice being done. When you watch On the Waterfront, it's the story of a guy who is forced, basically, to stand up to the mob, and the mob controls the union. And so if you want a job, you have to somehow give in to the union, pay money to the union, accept the domination of the union. Marlon Brando, in one of his greatest roles, plays this guy who is unwilling in the end to give in. And the scene where he has been beaten up towards the end of the movie, and if he can physically walk the length of the pier and get to the place where you get hired, it will have begun to break the power of the union and the power of the mob. That sequence is among the most powerful ever shot. So I hope this gives you a little flavor of how I see movies. Movies both help shape the culture, and movies respond to the culture. I hope it might lead you to look at a few more movies on your own and to realize that there's an extraordinary world out there which has been growing now for about 120 years. Starting with early silent film and coming up through to where we are today. And it's going to continue to evolve into a virtual reality. It's going to continue to evolve into enhanced reality. It is one of the great American contributions to the artistic achievements and something that we should be very, very proud of. You can learn more about my favorite movies, along with links to watch them, at our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Westwood One. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our editor is Robert Borowski, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. Our guest booker is Grace Davis. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. The music was composed by Joey Salvia. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360 and Westwood One's John Wardock and Robert Mathers. Please email me with your comments at newt@newtsworld.com. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. On the next episode of Newt's World, I bought into this idea that open global markets and information sharing would bring China out of its communist, totalitarian past. I don't think I could have gotten it more wrong.
These companies are listed on the U.S. stock exchange. Yes, they're based in China, but if they're listed on the U.S. exchange, they have to be valid because they're audited. They're beholden to the SEC and our rules and our listing standards on the NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange, so they have to be wrong. Every one of these companies were frauds.
I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World. The Westwood One Podcast Network.